Chapter 35. It was late in the afternoon. Darfur and the two vipers that Pitt and Giordino had subdued were handcuffed and driven away in patrol cars to the sheriff's department and booked for the murder of Egan's security guards. Kelly and Thomas gave their statements to the sheriff's homicide investigators, followed by Pitt and Giordino. Kelly was correct in saying the deputies would never catch Omo Kanai. Pitt traced the killer's tracks to the high cliffs above the Hudson River, where he found a rope leading down to the water. They must have escaped in a waiting boat, observed Giordino. Pitt stood with his friend in a gazebo at the edge of the palisade and stared down at the water. He lifted his gaze across the river to the green hills and forests. Small villages strayed along the New York shore in the part of the Hudson Valley made famous by Washington Irving. Amazing how Kanai covers every bet, every contingency. Do you think the vipers will talk under interrogation? It really wouldn't make much difference if they did, said Pitt slowly. The viper organization probably works in cells, each ignorant of the other, under the command of Kanai. As far as they know, the chain of command stops with him. I'll bet none of them are aware their true bosses sit in the corporate offices of Cerberus. It stands to reason they're too smart to leave a trail leading to the doorstep. Pitt nodded. Government prosecutors will never find enough hard evidence to convict them. If they're ever punished for their hideous crimes, it won't be under the law. Kelly walked across the lawn from the house to the gazebo. You too hungry? I'm always hungry, Giordino said, smiling. I fixed a light dinner while Josh mixed the drinks. He makes mean margaritas. Dear heart, Pitt put his arm around her waist. You just said the magic word. To say that Dr. Elmore Egan's taste in decorating was eclectic would be an understatement. The living room was furnished in early colonial. The kitchen had obviously been designed by a high-tech engineer whose passion ran more to exotic appliances than gourmet cooking, and the dining room looked like it had come straight from a Viking farm, its chairs and tables crafted from heavy oak, with matching chairs carved and sculpted with intricate patterns and designs. While Pitt, Giordino, and Thomas savored margaritas that could have jumped from their glasses and walked away, Kelly dished up a tuna casserole with coleslaw. Despite the trauma of the day, everyone ate normally. Afterward, they retired to the living room and replaced the uprooted pieces of furniture to their proper positions while Thomas poured everyone a glass of 40-year-old port. Pitt looked at Kelly. You told Kanai that your father's formula was hidden in the laboratory. She glanced at Thomas as if seeking permission. He smiled slightly and nodded his approval. Dad's formula is in a file folder that fits in a hidden panel in back of the door. Giordino swirled the port slowly in his glass. He'd have fooled me. I would never have looked for it inside a door. Your dad was a clever man. And Josh is a brave man, Giordino said respectfully. Despite a nasty beating, he told Kanai nothing. Thomas shook his head. Believe me, if Dirk had not walked into the room when he did, I would have spilled the secret of the formula's hiding place to save Kelly further torture. Maybe, said Pitt. But when they saw they couldn't beat it out of you, they switched their efforts to Kelly. They could come back, perhaps even tonight, said Kelly uneasily. No, Pitt assured her. Kanai would need time to put another team together. He won't try again soon. We'll take every precaution, said Thomas seriously. Kelly must leave the house and go into hiding. I agree, said Pitt. Kanai will no doubt assume that you will secrete the formula someplace other than the farm, which still leaves the two of you their only key to finding it. I could go to Washington with you and Al, said Kelly with a mischievous gleam in her eye. I'll be safe under your care. I'm not sure yet whether we're going back to Washington. Pitt set down his empty glass. Could you please show us Dr. Egan's laboratory? There's not much to see, said Thomas. He led them from the house to the barn. Inside were three counters upon which sat the usual apparatus seen in most chemistry laboratories. It's not very exciting, but it's where we formulated and developed Slick 66. Pitt walked around the room. Not exactly what I was expecting. Thomas looked at him queerly. I'm not following you. This can't be where Dr. Egan conceived and designed his magnetohydrodynamic engines, Pitt said firmly. Why do you say that? Asked Thomas cautiously. This room is a chemistry lab, no more. Dr. Egan was a brilliant engineer. I see no drafting tables, no computers programmed for displaying three-dimensional components, no facilities or machinery to construct working models. I'm sorry, but this is not where an inventive mind would create a great advance in propulsion technology. Pitt paused and stared at both Kelly and Thomas, whose eyes were cast on the stained wooden floor. What I can't figure out is why you're both stroking me. Kelly and I are hiding nothing from you, Mr. Pitt, said Thomas seriously. The truth is, we do not know where Elmore conducted his research. He was a fine man and a good friend, but he had a secretive streak that was nothing short of fanatical. Elmore would disappear for days, sometimes weeks, in a secret research laboratory whose location was known only to him. Kelly and I tried to follow him on different occasions, but he somehow always knew and eluded us. It was as if he were a ghost who vanished whenever he desired. Do you think the secret lab is here on the farm? Asked Pitt. We don't know, replied Kelly. When we were certain Dad had left the farm on business or research trips, Josh and I looked everywhere but never found a clue to its location. What was Dr. Egan researching when he died? Thomas shrugged helplessly. I have no idea. He refused to take me into his confidence. He only said it would revolutionize science and technology. You were his closest friend, said Giordino. It's odd that he never confided in you. You'd have to have known Elmore. He was two people. One minute the absent-minded but lovable father and friend. The next, a paranoid master engineer who trusted no one, not even those closest to him. Did he ever take time for pleasure? Inquired Pitt. Josh and Kelly looked at each other. He was incredibly passionate about researching the Vikings, said Thomas. He was also a dedicated fan of Jules Verne, added Kelly. He read his works over and over. Pitt motioned around the laboratory. I see no indication of any such passions. Kelly laughed. We haven't shown you his library. I'd like to see it. It's in a separate building beside the house, overlooking the river. Dad built it almost 20 years ago. It was his home away from home, his sanctuary from the pressures of his work. The building that housed Egan's study was made of stone and appeared to be designed after an 18th-century grain mill. Slate covered the roof, and ivy rose on the rock walls. The only admission to modern convenience was the skylights in the roof. Thomas used a large, old-fashioned key to unlock the thick oak door. The interior of the library was what Pitt had imagined. The rows of mahogany bookshelves and the paneled walls oozed finesse and refinement. The big, overstuffed chairs and couch were leather, and the desk, still littered with research papers, was a huge rosewood roll top. The ambience smothered the visitors with comfort and solace. This library must have fit Egan like a snug, well-worn glove, Pitt thought. It was an ideal setting in which to conduct research. He walked along the bookshelves that ran from floor to ceiling. A ladder with wheels on its upper frames moved along a track, enabling Egan to reach the top shelves. Paintings of Viking ships hung on the only open wall. On a table below the paintings sat a model of a submarine nearly 4 feet in length. Pitt guessed the scale at a quarter of an inch to the foot. As a marine engineer himself, Pitt studied the model closely, noting the exact craftsmanship. The boat was rounded on the ends, with portholes along the sides and a small tower that sat toward the bow. The propeller's blades were shaped more like paddles than the curved tips of modern designs. Pitt had never seen a craft quite like it. The only comparison he could think of was a diagram of a submarine he'd studied once that had been built by the Confederates during the Civil War. The brass plaque on the base beneath the model read, Nautilus, 70 meters in length with an 8-meter beam, launched 1863. A beautiful model, said Pitt. Captain Nemo's submarine, isn't it? From 20,000 leagues under the sea? Dad designed it from an etching in the original book and found a master model builder by the name of Fred Tourneau to construct it. Classic work, said Giordino admiringly. Pitt continued his tour, examining the titles of the books on the shelves. They all covered the Viking era from 793 to 1450 A.D. One entire section was devoted to the runic alphabets used by the Germanic and Norse people from the 3rd to the 13th centuries. Kelly watched Pitt's interest in the books and came up, holding his arm. Dad became expert at translating the characters found on runestones throughout the country. He believed the Vikings came this far south? She nodded. He was convinced. When I was little, he dragged Mother and me around half the Midwestern states in an old camper while he copied and studied every runestone he could find. Couldn't have been a large number, said Giordino. He found and recorded over 35 stones with ancient runic alphabets. She paused and pointed to one entire shelf of binders and notebooks. It's all right there. Did he ever intend to publish his findings? Asked Giordino. Not as far as I knew. About 10 years ago, it was as if a light switch had been turned off. He suddenly lost all interest in his Viking research. From one fixation to another, said Thomas. After the Vikings, Elmore immersed himself in Jules Verne. He swept a hand across one entire bookcase. He collected every book, every story Verne ever wrote. Pitt pulled one of the books from the shelf and opened it. The covers were leather-bound. Gold lettering on the spine and front cover read, Mysterious Island. Many of the pages were heavily underlined. He returned it to the shelf and stepped back. I see no bound papers or notebooks concerning Verne. Apparently Dr. Egan read the books but wrote no commentaries. Thomas looked exhausted from the traumatic events of the day. He slowly lowered himself into a leather chair. Elmore's dedication to Verne and the Vikings is something of a mystery. He was not the kind of man who drove himself to become an expert on a subject purely for pleasure. I never knew him to gain specific knowledge without a purpose. Pitt looked at Kelly. Did he ever tell you why he was so absorbed in the Vikings? It wasn't so much the lore and history of the culture as the runic inscriptions. Giordino took one of Egan's Viking notebooks from the shelf and opened it. His eyes squinted as he thumbed through the pages, his face registering bafflement. He flipped through the pages of a second notebook, then a third. Then he looked up, utterly mystified, as he passed the notebooks to the others standing beside him. It looks like Dr. Egan was more of an enigma than any of you knew. They all studied the notebooks and then looked at each other in puzzled incomprehension. All the pages in all the notebooks were blank. I don't understand, said Kelly, looking totally lost. Nor I, added Thomas. Kelly opened two more notebooks and found them empty as well. I vividly remember the family trips into the backwoods searching for runestones. When he found one, he would highlight the rune fonts with talcum powder before photographing them. Then, while we camped nearby in the evening, he would translate the messages. I used to pester him, and he'd shoo me away as he scribbled in his notebooks. I saw him make notations with my own eyes.
Not in these books, said Pitt. None of the pages look as if they'd been removed and replaced with blank pages. Your father must have hidden the original notebooks elsewhere.
No doubt gathering dust in the lost laboratory you talk about, said Giordino, whose respect for Elmore Egan had dropped a couple of notches.
Kelly's lovely face was flushed with bewilderment, and her sapphire blue eyes seemed to be trying to see something that was not there.
Why would Dad do such things? I always remember a man who was so straight and honest, he didn't have a devious bone in his body.
He must have had a good reason, Thomas said, in an attempt to comfort her. Pitt looked down at her compassionately. It's getting late. We're not going to solve anything tonight. I suggest we sleep on it, and maybe we'll come up with some answers in the light of day. No one gave him an argument. They were all dead tired. All except Pitt. He was the last one to leave the library. He pretended to lock the door before he handed the key to Thomas. Later, when everyone was asleep, he quietly returned to the library and entered through the unlocked door. Then he turned on the lights and began searching through Egan's research material on the runestones. A trail and a story began to emerge. By 4 in the morning, he had found what he was looking for. Many answers still eluded him, but the mud in the water had cleared just enough for him to get a glimpse of the bottom. Happily satisfied, he fell asleep in one of the comfortable leather chairs, inhaling the quaint smell of the old books.